From the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College, this is the Candidate Forum on Business and the Economy, sponsored by Lincoln Financial Group, produced in partnership with the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire, New Hampshire Union Leader, New Hampshire Public Radio, and New Hampshire Public Television.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Candidate Forum on Business and the Economy. I'm Laura Kanoy, host of New Hampshire Public Radio's The Exchange. We're coming to you from the television studio at the Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. For the next hour, we'll hear candidates for the 1st Congressional District. We will try to press them about what they would do as members of Congress and refrain from spending valuable time attacking each other. And now, let's introduce our candidates. They are incumbent Republican Frank Ginta and Democrat Carol Shea Porter. Our panelists are Mike Cody from the New Hampshire Union Leader and Phil Vaughn from New Hampshire Public Television. Now, during the first half hour of our forum, the panelists will ask questions. Then we'll move on to a lightning round where candidates will provide brief and decisive responses to a series of topics. Then I'll take over and moderate a two-way discussion between the candidates. Some of the questions we'll hear came from our readers, listeners, and viewers. In the beginning, you'll have 2 minutes for your response, and if there's a follow-up question, we'll give you 1 minute. Now, we tossed a coin earlier to see who would receive that first question, and it goes to Mr. Ginta, and the questioner is Mike Cody from the Union Leader. Mike.
Good morning, Mr. Ginta. The federal government is said to be approaching a fiscal cliff come January, when both the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the automatic spending cuts agreed to last fall will go into effect. What happens if we go over that cliff?
Well, thank you very much for the question. I want to thank all of you for attending this very important forum and debate. I want to thank the BIA and New Hampshire Public TV and New Hampshire Public Radio, as well as the Union Leader, for participating. We have a serious challenge that we face as a nation, which is why I think in 2010 so many people decided that we needed a directional change relative to policy in our country. So here's what we face. We face the expiration of all of the existing tax rates in this country. The President of the United States, Barack Obama, has said that we shouldn't raise taxes during a recession. I agree with that statement. I think that we need to extend those rates, try to give some understanding and long-term understanding of what fiscal policy will be to our job creators, to our small business owners here in New Hampshire and the country. And we have already voted in the House of Representatives to extend all of those rates. So I hope that we have bipartisan cooperation from the United States Senate in taking that action and ensuring that job creators, ensuring that our entrepreneurs have that understanding of what basic fiscal policy will be coming out of Washington. That's one of the most critical concerns I hear as I travel around and meet different business owners in New Hampshire, is that they don't have the predictability as to what policy will be. And that is not right, it's not fair, and it makes it very, very difficult for business owners, job creators, to invest in their own business, to expand, to hire individuals. So if we can at least give that predictability and do what I think most people would agree in extending all of those rates, just as the President of the United States has stated, we should not be raising taxes in a recession. That will begin, I think, the focus of a long-term pro-growth economic return.
If we go over the cliff and it's really bad, what would you do as a member of Congress?
Well, we can't go over the cliff. The reality is that we can't go over the cliff. We have $16 trillion in debt. We have $16 trillion in our GDP. That ratio is not good for America. It's not good for the strongest nation in the world. We see different ratios already in Greece and other countries out in Europe. So I don't even want to get to the point where what happens if. We have to make sure that it does not happen.
Ms. Shea Porter, same question to you.
Well, when Mr. Ginta talked about going in a new direction in 2010, I don't think that the American public thought it meant over the cliff. And that's exactly the direction they have driven us. Mr. Ginta and his party are responsible for what's coming up now because he, as a Tea Party member, and his fellow cohorts refused to raise the debt ceiling, pushed us into this deal, the sequester deal, knowing full well that it wasn't going to work. As they walked in, they actually said that they would not compromise. And so now here we are at this cliff. Mr. Ginta, after saying that Washington should stay in Congress should stay in Washington and work on these problems left without passing any kind of the so-called extension of the Bush tax cuts. The difference between Mr. Ginta and the president is that Mr. Ginta would like to continue tax cuts for everybody over the amount of $250,000. The president and the Democrats want everybody to have $250,000 as the first marker there. And then after that, we go back to it's not really a tax increase, it's just returning to what the president, President Bush, had determined at the beginning when they passed those tax cuts. They were not meant to be permanent. So Mr. Ginta needs to get back to Washington, and he needs to extend those tax cuts for the middle class and for everybody on the first $250,000. They also have to work on a budget that's acceptable, and they have to raise the debt ceiling. The money is already spent. And so they have a responsibility to the public and to businesses in this country to make sure that they get this right, and they do it now.
If there's not a resolution here, what parts of New Hampshire's economy are most at risk?
Well, I think everybody would be hurt, and certainly Mr. Ginta has put the shipyard and the defense industry at risk, many, many thousands of jobs, because the cuts, the sequester cuts, call for, and they knew it. They called for 50% cuts 50% of the cuts would be on the defense side, 50% of the cuts would be on the domestic side. And so, of course, that would include a lot of these defense jobs and a lot of jobs also on the domestic side. So they knew that. They pushed this deal, the Tea Party pushed this deal, because they would not raise the debt ceiling, which has happened many, many times. It's money that was already spent. And so now here we are facing this sequester. We got this sequester. Now we have to deal with this. And it's absolutely at the feet of the Tea Party Republicans like Mr. Ginta.
Well, and our next question comes from my colleague Phil Vaughn, but I do want to give you a chance to jump in, Mr. Ginta. Ms. Shea Porter said that your party is responsible for putting us here because you refused to raise the debt limit. So this agreement was struck where automatic spending cuts would go into place. What do you say to that?
Well, there's a lot of attacks that I need to respond to in those first remarks. Here's the situation. The President of the United States, the Majority Leader, Harry Reid, in the Senate, had demanded that we include a sequester in any agreement with the House of Representatives. Actually, in looking for bipartisanship, in looking for a cooperative spirit, we tried to come up with something that they would agree to. Now, sequester has turned out to be a terrible idea. I think most people would agree with that. We have corrected that issue in the House, not once but twice, and then again last week we voted for a third time on replacing the cuts in the sequester, and we gave actually the Senate more options in terms of spending reductions than are actually necessary to eliminate the sequester. So we said, here are the groups of options that we passed bipartisanly in the House of Representatives, asking the Senate, of those, what would you accept? So we are very willing to resolve a mistake that occurred, but it was at the demand and request of the President and Senator Harry Reid.
And we'll probably get back to this topic a little later in the program, but Ms. Shea Porter, Congressman Ginta said we need to extend the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts, to everyone, to all levels, including those making over $250,000, the job creators. What about that? There is concern that if you raise taxes above that level, that those folks won't create jobs, that wealthy people might spend less and depress the whole economy.
Okay, first let me say that they did not vote for the sequester, only on the defense side, not the domestic, so it's not done. But the truth is that everybody would get a tax cut on the first $250,000. I would prefer $300,000, but everybody gets a tax cut on the first $250,000. It's after that we revert back to the Clinton days, when everybody thought that was working very well and it was good for the economy. We had a surplus until George Bush came into office. So I think that pretty much answers it, that it worked very well and that business is worth thriving, and that's what we need to do. We need to make sure that there's revenue there, that we can't extend permanently tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires as Mr. Ginta and the Tea Party would like to do.
Well, let's go back to our panel now, and our next question comes from my colleague Phil Vaughn from New Hampshire Public Television. Go ahead, Phil.
Ms. Shea Porter, health care costs in New Hampshire are among the highest in the country. Debate still rages on the Affordable Care Act, a law you support. What further changes would you make if elected?
Well, I think, first of all, that we recognize that people are now understanding it better, that there aren't death panels there, that we are going to be able to control costs more efficiently, and that more people have access. They're already seeing the benefits of that. They know that their children are on the health care policy. Seniors are getting the 50% discount on drugs. We're closing the donut hole with that, this free preventive care, et cetera. So we're seeing a lot of good things. But I think what we need to be doing now is paying much more attention to how we deliver health care. There's still a lot of waste and fraud and inefficiency. So I think it's going to now move on to the next phase. We put a lot of that in the bill, but I think I would like to improve that and do better studies and comparisons about what works, what doesn't, what hospitals have better rates of success and what don't, and penalize those that are driving up costs without delivering effective health care. So I think that's where we need to start focusing now that we've managed to produce a very consumer-friendly law that will help millions of Americans.
Some New Hampshire businesses have expressed concerns about the law. They're worried about the cost of the mandate and the fines they will have to pay if they don't. How do you make them feel better?
Well, first of all, we know that the cost of their premiums had jumped dramatically. In a dozen years, they had jumped about 70% after you adjust for inflation. So the costs were really, really being driven up. Now, for companies that have a smaller number of employees, they're going to be able to continue deducting, and they have very huge deductions for their tax premiums. For the larger companies, what will be good for everybody, I believe, because people did ask, and they did ask for employer-delivered health care. That's what they wanted instead of a single-payer system. But what they will get is they will get a healthier, more productive group of employees. And it's also one of the benefits that they, as I indicated, wanted to offer at the time. So I think what we'll see as we pool people together and we bring young people into the insurance pool, because everybody needs to be insured, that the cost will go down, that we will have, I mean, it's always going to increase, but the increase will be smaller, and that we'll have healthier employees, and we'll have more insured. So we'll be saving both on the end of the hospital where people go when they don't have health insurance. So we'll be saving as taxpayers, we'll be saving as healthcare consumers, and we'll be saving as business people.
Mr. Ginta, you want to repeal the Affordable Health Care Act. When asked last week about the law, Mr. Mitt Romney said he would keep parts of the reform. What parts of the Affordable Care Act would you preserve?
Well, let's go back and talk a little bit about first what's in the Affordable Care Act. And I disagree with my opponent here, who says that health care costs are always going to go up. We should be striving to find a way to reduce health care costs. I think we all agree with that. But there's 21 taxes in this Affordable Care Act. It started out as an $800 billion bill, according to the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. It has now been rescored at the request of the Senate after the United States Supreme Court decision, where it's now costing $1.8 trillion. There is a penalty for, I would say, small business owners. Anyone over 50, a business that has 50 or more employees, has to, by law, provide government-sponsored health insurance. And if it doesn't, it is fined $2,000 per employee. That's our job creators in this country. That's our entrepreneurs. That's small business owners sitting right here in this room, right here in New Hampshire, that drive the economy. I don't think that's a good prescription for the challenges that we have in affordability and access. There's a couple things I would do. I do support the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. I did sponsor legislation that passed in the House to oppose it. What we need to do is have a much more free market approach, number one. What does that mean? We need to have more opportunities here in New Hampshire and across the region to have individuals purchase health insurance. So you've got to bring more competition. Secondly, you need transparency. Nobody in this room could tell you right now how much it costs to scope your knee at five different hospitals here in the state of New Hampshire. That is wrong. It is not a consumer-driven approach. And if you start with those two things, you will dramatically change the course of access to care, the cost of care, and you'll continue to see what I think we have in this country, which is the highest quality of care.
Recent reports show that more people are insured and that premium rate increases are slowing. Do you credit the Affordable Care Act for that?
I haven't seen a study that shows premium, you're saying premium increases are slowing.
Right, 4% okay. This past year compared to higher rates.
I haven't seen that study, and I'm not sure that that would be accurate, because it's not a fair reflection of what I hear from business owners here in New Hampshire. I have yet to meet anybody who said to me, thank goodness for the Affordable Care Act, because it slowed my increase. What people are looking for is a reduction in what is a growing part of the pie for business owners. When you sit down and you have to create a budget as a CEO or as an executive or as a small business owner, you have two or three major components. Salaries and expenses and healthcare are a great percentage of them. You want to try to figure out how to reduce that healthcare component so you can put more of your revenue back in your business, hire individuals, have job growth. So I'm not hearing people tell me that they are thankful for the Affordable Care Act because it's slowed the growth. What I'm hearing is that it's requiring people to hire more in compliance areas, that it's costing them job creation, and that it's not providing predictability in terms of the cost of health care.
So what would you propose to reduce or at least address the rising costs?
Sure, there's a number of things we can do to address the rising costs. Number one, you've got to have more competition. We need more carriers writing here in New Hampshire. Secondly, I've talked to the insurance commissioner here in New Hampshire asking the basic question, can we go after a geographic area, region, either northern New England or New England, and try to have a regional approach, establish relationships and agreements with the other states for greater access? The answer is yes, according to our insurance commissioner. So, for example, if you have a business right here in Manchester and you have a policy written from a carrier in Connecticut and it's cheaper than the one you have here in New Hampshire, you should be able to access that. Under the law, you can't. Third, right now, when you ask physicians how much time they spend on testing to ensure that they don't get sued, despite the fact that they know the ultimate diagnosis, that is a significant cost increase. Those three items right there should be three things that we should be focusing on immediately to reduce the cost of health care and to ensure that our job creators don't have to lay people off as a result of this piece of legislation.
Do I get to answer? That was a number of outrageous claims.
I think I can give you 30 seconds for that, and then
okay.
Phil has another question
okay,
on
first
energy
let me say
policy.
It's not government-sponsored, and starting from Frank Ginta's claim that it's government-sponsored when it's all insurance companies, you can just figure that the rest of it's not so either. And if he'd been out there talking to people and talking to businesses, he would have recognized that they wanted a health care program here. And what we have are it's being delivered by individual insurance companies. It is not government-sponsored. And the other problem is that they can choose. They'll have more choice. There'll be more insurance companies. We only had two insurance companies active in New Hampshire. And the compact that he's talking about where you can get together different states, they can do that with the state exchanges and form like a New England compact. And everything else, everybody knows that costs go up. For him to say that health care costs should actually drop when nothing else ever drops is just it's just not accurate. So looking at the whole picture, I think that Mr. Ginta needs to actually read that health care bill.
Well, let's go to Phil Vaughn again and an energy question. Phil?
Mr. Ginta, gas prices are soaring. High energy costs are a big problem for New Hampshire businesses. What changes in laws are needed to address this?
Before I answer that, my opponent continues to say that costs should be going up and need to go up and that it's you business owners and job creators should expect that to occur. I take a very different approach. I think as a steward of taxpayer dollars, we need to be finding ways to be more effective, more efficient with taxpayer dollars, and we should actually try to come to the table and tell you how we're going to reduce costs. I know every business owner that I engage actually does try to figure out how to reduce their expenditures so they can put more dollars back into their business. In terms of energy, we need an above all of the energy approach in this country. Let's talk about fossil fuels for a moment. We have 19 million barrels of oil a day that we utilize as a nation. We only produce 7 million barrels a day here in the United States. So the numbers don't make sense in terms of our exploration and our production versus our usage. That's one area where we can narrow the gap. But secondly, we should be focusing on alternatives. And I support the notion of focusing alternatives. But the reality is the market is going to determine what alternative is going to be best for a particular region in the country. So, for example, wind in New Hampshire may work in certain parts of New Hampshire, certain geographic locations, but in others they're not, just based on the topography, and as well the cost of running that operation. But the focus needs to be, let's explore, which we're not doing right now to the levels we should be. Let's reduce our consumption, which there are many easy ways we can reduce consumption and save. But the key really is having an above-all energy program that's going to give us multiple choices, multiple options. We're not seeing that come out of this administration. What we're seeing out of this administration is choosing winners and losers. And Solyndra is a great example of that. Forcing taxpayer dollars to go to someone like Solyndra that goes belly up does not solve the energy crisis and the energy challenge. And you look, when you drive home today, if you need to fill up, it's going to cost you $3.85 for a gallon of gas. I mean, 2 weeks ago, it was $3.70. 2 weeks ago. So you can't continue to see this spike in gas. That affects every single person in America. It affects everyone, regardless of where you're working, whether you're middle class, whether you're retired. It affects the cost of your groceries when you go grocery shopping. This has got to be a key central theme for the next administration, whoever that is, in moving the country forward on a key principle for a reduction of cost to individuals.
Yeah. Thank you.
Are there any alternative energies that government should subsidize?
Well, if you want to get into tax policy, I think there's a couple of ways we can go. I mean, you can get rid of all subsidies 100%, or if you're going to, you know, focus on subsidies, you give everyone the same. But you've got to do one or the other. The government cannot be picking and choosing who gets a subsidy and who doesn't. What I think we need to do, again, is have that all-of-the-above approach. And an all-of-the-above approach will allow biomass, biofuel, wind, solar. It will be able to bring those individuals and businesses into the mix, but they've got to be able to do it based on a competitive model. You know, again, Solyndra is the great example. Giving Solyndra taxpayer money, knowing full well the federal government knew that this was a risky endeavor, and taxpayers are out of those dollars, and we still don't have a resolution to the spiking gas prices in this country.
Ms. Shea Porter, same question. What changes in laws are needed to address the rising cost of energy?
Well, first let me say that Mr. Ginter did a very good job representing the oil company there. He receives a great deal of oil money, and he did a very good job representing them. But that, he also did a very good job, by the way, up in North Conway when people talked about those oil subsidies. And he said, well, you know, to be fair, if you take the oil subsidies away, then they shouldn't have to pay for leases. Now, the leases are on public land. That is our oil, the public oil. So right from the beginning, I don't think Mr. Ginter is quite accurate with this story. I believe in all of the above, and so does the president. It is an all of the above strategy. But that means if he says you shouldn't be picking winners and losers, then I would like to know why he's not continuing subsidies and tax credits for alternative renewable energy and yet votes to increase them and continue them for oil companies and others. If you're not going to be involved in the market, then stay out. But subsidizing, which he does, he votes to subsidize oil companies, and he will not help the renewables.
What votes are you referencing?
You know exactly what I'm talking about, Mr. Ginter. It was in the, if you look in the Ryan budget, if you look in all of those bills there, you have not been helpful to the renewable energy. But by the way,
what subsidies are you talking about? No, what subsidies are you talking about?
I'm going to continue on my time. If
that's just false. That's just false.
So let me just say that I do believe that right now we have to do all of the above, and I think it's very important that we invest in the renewable energy. And so does the Department of Defense, by the way. They have been investing in renewable energy, renewable fuels. And the Republicans actually tried to stop the government from using the military from using renewable fuels. But they recognize that a problem is coming. They also know that if we continue our dependency on the Middle East, it's risking our national security because we have to go there to get that oil. Now, fortunately, because of the president's policies, we have been using less oil. We have reduced the amount of oil there, and we do have domestic consumption and domestic production. And I think all of the above is an important phrase, but we actually need to live it and practice it in legislation.
And candidates, you're doing a great job. I'd love to remind you to just keep an eye on the time as we're trying to get through lots of issues here. Mr. Ginch, I'm going to give you just a quick 15 seconds to respond to Ms. Shea Porter's critique that you have supported subsidies for oil and gas.
Well, I asked during her remark to name what piece of legislation she's referencing. And I didn't hear a specific answer. So if she's got a specific piece of legislation that she's referencing, I'll respond to it.
Does the Republican budget include oil and gas subsidies?
What the Republican budget passed twice, this year and last year, does is a number of things. By the way, you know, when my opponent was in the House of Representatives, the House never did budgets. I mean, let's just start with that issue. How are you going to run the country if you don't have the document, the budget, to determine what fiscal policy is going to be, what energy policy is going to be? So here's what we've done in our budget proposals that passed the House, and we were told immediately by Senator Reid, the majority leader, that they would not take up a budget in the Senate.
Mr.
I have to say, at least
so
the
sorry,
President...
For the interest of time, can
sure.
you address, does the House Republican budget include oil and gas subsidies? Because that's the charge that Ms. Shea Porter is making.
It does not.
It does not. All right. Let's move on to another question from Mike Cody from the Union Leader. Mike, go ahead, please.
Ms. Shea Porter, one of the few bright spots in the nation's economy is our manufacturing sector. How would you ensure that manufacturing in this country is competitive globally?
Okay, well, first of all, I think that we need to reward companies that manufacture here in the United States. It brings jobs. We consume stuff all the time. We just don't make it here. So we need to make sure that we have to allow them to set up in places that are economically challenged, to give them tax credits to be in those places. We need to help them to export. It's not really a fair and level field in exports because other countries support manufacturing a lot better than the United States does. So we need to allow them to expense their equipment faster and take a full expense for the equipment, full deductions there. So we need to recognize that in order to continue what we're seeing here with job creation in manufacturing, that we need to be strong supporting these manufacturing industries that actually produce here in the United States. That means that we can't continue to give subsidies to companies that take the companies overseas. They have a right to do that. It is American. You can do what you want. But we shouldn't help them by saying, okay, the cost of moving can be deductible. The cost of training employees can be deductible. We have to do everything we can to have a tax policy that supports manufacturing right here in the United States.
Our manufacturing businesses would also like more free trade. How does free trade affect the average Granite State worker?
Well, free trade, we know, has been disastrous for most American workers. So when you look and you see what happens when the jobs go overseas, because there really isn't such a thing. I don't like to say free trade. I like to say fair trade. So we need to make sure that other companies will take our products like we take their products. That's one of the biggest problems that we have, that other countries don't open their doors to American products like we do to theirs. So that's a very critical component. But also, when you send the jobs overseas, you hurt workers in this country. And workers are the ones that grow the economy from the middle out. They're the ones that have the money and go into the stores and shop at the places that we all like to support. So it's absolutely critical that we have right here the jobs made here and a government program that supports industries in the United States when they're out on the world market. And we also need to help our companies to export, especially our smaller companies, that they need to have the support structure there to do that.
Mr. Ginta, same question. How do you ensure that we remain competitive globally?
Well, there's a couple of points there. Number one, I've held three different manufacturing summits throughout the district to talk about manufacturing here in New Hampshire. And one of the things I think we need to do is bring our education community, high school, as well as community colleges and our university system, into a better relationship with business owners and try to learn a little bit more from our business owners about what kind of manufacturing we do here in the state. Most people think of when I was a kid, my father took me to get the car fixed on Saturday morning, and it was, you know, you had a person who came out of the garage who had grease all over him and all over his hands, and you were told not to stay in the garage. Today, our manufacturing is high tech. It's clean. It's ISO required, which means you can walk onto a manufacturing floor, and it's just as clean as a hospital in some circumstances. we actually have a challenge. Some manufacturers in our state are having a problem finding educated workforce. The problem isn't so much that the manufacturing jobs aren't here. I've talked to a lot of manufacturers who say, we're looking to hire, but we can't find someone who has the specific education or skill set toward our high-precision job. So that's one thing we need to do. Secondly, let's talk about free trade. If you go down the street to Merrimack and you go to GT Solar and you make the statement that fair trade has been terrible to our workers, that my opponent just made, think about what GT Solar creates. They create panels that are sold overseas. The jobs are here, right here in New Hampshire. You shut down that free trade agreement, every single one of those jobs goes away. That is not the kind of policy that we should have here in America. One of the things that we were able to do in a bipartisan way was pass free trade agreements, with Colombia especially. The House, the Senate signed into law by the President of the United States. So, I mean, we are looking for ways to try to work together to move the economy forward. We have done some of those things. But the reality is there's so much more that needs to be done on tax policy, on the Affordable Care Act, on energy policy, and on regulatory policy to get the sort of stagnation of our unemployment, of the 43 months of continued unemployment over 8%, going in a different direction.
So on the skills gap you're talking about, what's the role of the federal government in helping to close that gap?
Well, there's a number of things we can do on the federal level. What I prefer to see, though, is policy that on the federal level that is pro-growth. So it's about tax, it's about energy costs. I mean, if you want to build a manufacturing plant here in New Hampshire, we have some of the highest electric rates in the nation. You're going to be anti-competitive there with companies down in the South, for example. So we could be losing. So talk about what we could do on the federal level. Let's deal with the energy policy.
Well, with the
Let's
skills
deal
gap
with the tax
in particular,
policy.
Excuse me.
I think that's probably relegated more to a state issue or a local issue. But the reality is, just by myself hosting three different manufacturing summits, I was able to partner, not legislatively, not by forcing something, but by bringing the business community together with the education community and making that relationship, and then having the business owner talk about what are the skills needed, and then change the curriculum, you know, at the high school level, at the community college level, in geographic regions in the state, I think would be a huge improvement from what we have today.
We need to wrap up this
Can I comment
portion very quickly. Yes, you may.
Thank you.
About 30 seconds.
Actually, it's interesting that he doesn't think there's a federal role, because what we have been hearing is that we need federal investment in research and development to share with industry faster. The university system has been drastically cut 50% by the state. They are reliant on federal funds for research and development. The community colleges partner, and there is federal money there to partner and to educate. And what I heard on Education and Labor Committee was that, and business came before us much more often, that they needed to have a policy they could count on around the country that focused on training young people so they would have the skills to enter the workforce. So there is a federal partnership. Right now there's money in a...
Go ahead, wrap up, please.
Okay, there's money in a venture company that is attracting capital, but it's being backed by $4.5 million of federal money so they can attract investors into the state for business. So there is a role, and to suggest that there isn't is not accurate.
Super quick, Mr. Ginta, is there no federal role?
I didn't say there was no federal role, number one. I said we've got to deal with tax policy, we've got to deal with energy policy, which is a direct impact on manufacturing here in New Hampshire and across the country. But secondly, what you're hearing here is from my opponent, government, big government solutions all the time. And I don't think that's necessary. I mean, I simply held a forum where we brought educators in the same room as job creators and manufacturers and said, let's talk about the connectivity between the two. And, you know, our university system favors that. Our high schools favor that. And our community colleges favor that. So it doesn't always have to be a big government solution.
All right.
You can actually focus on working collaboratively here in the state to try to address the issues, deal with fiscal policy on the federal level to get the economy moving.
And that's the problem with the Tea Party right there.
And
they think it's always big government.
I do need to jump in. We are going to have a long-form segment in just a few minutes, and my question in that form will be focused on creating jobs. So promise we'll be able to get back to that. We are going going to move now to our lightning round. This is where we ask a straightforward question that can be answered quickly and simply, as in yes or no. Dollar amounts, numbers, and so forth. Extra points, I think, from the audience, you two, for the candidate who is able to answer the question quickly and decisively. Now, here's a heads up. Our last lightning round question is a little different, so I do want to give you just a little time up ahead to think about it. Our last question will be, sum up your economic philosophy in a tweet. So you'll have 140 characters. Our first lightning round questions will come from my colleague, Phil Vaughn. Go ahead, Phil.
This question actually came from a New Hampshire Public Television viewer, Ms. Shea Porter. What one government department or agency would you eliminate if you could?
I don't think I would eliminate any of them. I think what we need to do, the reason they're created is because people come together, Republicans and Democrats, to vote for those because they recognize the need. Now, I would certainly look hard at finding the efficiencies. I think many of them are bloated. But the reason that they're there is because Republicans and Democrats together saw that need and created them. So, you know, I'm sure it's tucked somewhere. There's an office that could leave. But in general, there's a reason that they were there.
Okay, lightning round. Go ahead.
Mr. Ginter, same question.
Well, I don't think when you ask people, generally speaking, is the federal government too big, too small, or just the right size, I don't think too many people say it's too small. You know, let's take the highway bill that we were able to pass and get signed into law. I was on the Transportation Infrastructure Committee. One of the things we were trying to accomplish on the federal on the House side was reducing the size of the agency itself.
So any specific agency you'd cut or just reduce the size?
We actually eliminated about 70 different programs within the agency. So we reduced that. But let's look at, you know, the statement that my opponent just made.
Mr. Ginter,
just
I'm
because
so sorry.
Something...
This is the lightning round, and we're trying to just do brief and decisive. We will have time for a longer form conversation, and I'll step back. But in the spirit of the lightning round, again, extra points for the candidate who can be brief and decisive. Our next question goes to Mike Cody. Go ahead, Mike.
Do you support, Mr. Ginter, do you support a voucher system for Medicare?
No, I do not.
Ms. Shea Porter.
I don't, but he does. It does. It's called the Ryan Plan. You can call it premium support, or you can call it voucher, but as Paul Ryan said, it's the same.
All right, next lightning round
question. I would love to explain the difference between premium support and voucher, because there is a very stark difference.
Next question.
Fair enough, actually.
Okay.
If you can be super short.
Okay. Voucher is a direct payment to the employee. Premium support is you get a choice, and you make your choices. The check is sent directly to the carrier. Two very different programs.
Mr. Ginter, should the Social Security retirement age be raised for young workers? Excuse me, this goes to Ms. Shea Porter first. If Social Security should it be raised, and if so, to what age?
No, I don't think it should be raised. You know, just like cars at 100,000 miles, we all arrive in different shape and different conditions. And there are people who are genetically predisposed to disease. There are others who are injured at work or have had jobs on their feet. There are other jobs where people could continue working until 90 and sit at desk. So I think to put a blanket there would put so many people at risk if they were unable to reach that age.
So the age is fine now?
Yes.
Mr. Ginter?
I think you got to have everything on the table here in trying to solve the mandatory side of spending, which is almost 60% of our budget, which includes Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Look, you know, my focus is trying to preserve and protect these programs. However, you've got to make sure that the programs fit the needs of today. And when Social Security, for example, was created, the life expectancy was very, very different than it is today. So thanks to technology, thanks to healthier living, we do live longer. So I think the program should understand that and make sure that it addresses the fiscal challenges that we have with it.
So
let's keep it all. Let's keep it all on the table and try to figure out what's the. Yeah, I think we should take all of it and consider what is the best reflection of our current age groups today.
Okay, Phil, next to you, lightning round.
Ms. Shea Porter, is the Postal Service operating too many small post offices?
Well, I'm sure there are post offices they can close, but the biggest problem that the post office has right now is they were forced to fund 75 years out for retirement. They were forced to fund people, future workers, who are not even born yet. And so that has been a big drain on them and not, so yes, it'll always be a post office or something that can be done. So my opponent gets confused. He thinks that we don't believe in efficient government. We believe in efficient, effective government. And nobody wants government on their backs, but we do. The American people want government on their side.
So there may be some post offices that could be closed.
Of course there would be. Yes.
Just a yes or no when you can would be great. Okay.
And Mr. Gitt, the same question.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to retool the entire postal service. There are some that can be closed throughout the nation. It does express, there is cause for concern in rural areas because of the fact that you have very little alternative access to those areas. So as you reform the postal service, you've got to consider that. But the reality on their retirement program, their pension program, is until we move from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan, you're not going to get at the systemic problem of their annual losses.
Okay.
Mr. Ginta, do you favor federal subsidies for high-speed rail development?
No, I don't, particularly in our region, because it's an extremely high expense, number one. Number two, it can't be self-sustaining. And third, you don't have the population base here. And I never quite understood, and I know that, you know, some chambers and probably some BIA members support the notion of having rail into New Hampshire, but I never quite understood this notion of sending our residents out of the state to work somewhere else. You know, I understand that, particularly as my tenure as a mayor, the economic impact along a corridor. But I think there's a lot of different ways that we can grow our economy here in New Hampshire.
Okay, so for here, no.
It doesn't make fiscal sense here in New England, in our region.
Same question.
I can't believe I just heard him say that we shouldn't be sending our people out to work in other places. So the reality is that our unemployment would shoot up quite a bit if we didn't send people over the border to work, especially here in Manchester and other places. Of course we need high-speed rail. Anybody who's ever traveled down the 93 corridor knows. Anybody who's had the pleasure of traveling in a train to work understands this is a good way to travel. It helps reduce our oil consumption. It helps reduce our congestion. And it's an easy way to go, and it's effective. And Mr. Ginta has no problem subsidizing highway development and other things, putting money there.
So that's a yes.
We should
for
put
high
it there,
rail.
Too.
Okay,
and I did. Where does the money come from?
And we'll definitely talk about that. I want to let my colleague, Mike Cody, ask the last lightning round question.
I get the fun question here. Every word, every character is precious. We're getting back to the question Laura referred to earlier in the program. How would you describe your economic philosophy in one tweet, 140 characters or less?
Pro-growth economic principles, predictability for job creators and entrepreneurs, and reducing federal government and oversight into our personal and business lives.
Ms. Shea Porter.
Pro-growth economic principles, working hard to support industry, both small business and large.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. That was quite lightning-ish. And I appreciate that. We're now going to switch gears and step back a little bit. I'm going to moderate a longer form discussion. I'll ask the candidates one broad question and then invite them to dialogue with each other on that question. And from what we've seen from these two so far, we know that will be a good dialogue. I will jump in only as necessary to make sure we're not going astray in terms of time or topic. And so the question is, politicians often talk about their jobs plan or bringing in jobs, but beyond getting job seekers and employers together at jobs fairs, which Mr. Ginta, you've mentioned, how much impact can one politician or one group of politicians have on job creation? I'm going to start this segment with you, Ms. Shea Porter, ask you that question and then step out. So go ahead and let's hear you both converse about it.
Actually, we can have a large impact and should have a large impact on jobs creation, for example, or saving jobs. For example, the auto industry, the domestic auto industry, is alive and well today because we voted to help save the auto industry. A jobs bill is a very effective way to increase jobs. We know that there's many things to be done in this country. We have to build infrastructure, for example, and the president did try to get a jobs bill through, but Frank Ginta and the Tea Party partners wouldn't accept that. So the government has a role to play to encourage jobs. We also, education, the research and development. is very critical for companies to have access to this so that they can be entrepreneurial and create jobs from that as well. So there is a partnership there. I mentioned that right now there's a venture capital firm that is attracting capital to New Hampshire by saying, by the federal funding, supporting it about to the tune of about $4.5 million. And that encourages individual investors to come in knowing that, that there'll be some money backing that investment. So it's going to be privately run. It's a great thing, but it has that. And all around, as you look, you see people at work, and they are in either private industry or working for the federal government, the state government, the local government, in really essential functions. We have to teach. We have to use education. We have to build our roads and our hospitals. We have to do the research. We have to check our food supply. There are many, many jobs. We have to police. We have to have security. We have to have defense. So all of these are things that legislators get to vote for. And when they vote repeatedly, like in the Ryan budget, that would eliminate in the first year or two, 1.7 million jobs.
These would be public sector jobs.
And you realize the impact. Well, it's not just public sector. Mm-hmm. It's not just public sector. There are many, many private jobs that would be eliminated. So based on the philosophy, now, Mr. Ginta's philosophy is that no government's probably the best. And he's been working his way towards that. No regulation, no government. Mine has been, I think there is a role to play to support private enterprise, to help launch them. The Small Business Administration helps launch small businesses. But ultimately, you know, private industry is the engine driver.
Well, let's get Mr. Ginta in, and please feel free to dialogue with each other. Go ahead, Mr. Ginta. Can politicians really create jobs, as they often say they do?
Well, there's a couple of points. Number one, I'd like to hear the citations for the facts that my opponent cites. I think that would be helpful in moving forward with an honest dialogue. Secondly, I think the role of a legislator is to create legislatively an environment where real job creators, our entrepreneurs, our small business owners, have the ability to do what they do best and create businesses, grow businesses, and help the local, state, and national economy. And we do have very different philosophies. What I heard in my opponent's answer was a lot about what federal government can be doing for you. So let's just take a look at the federal government, you know, through a couple of facts. You have 8.1% unemployment. You have unemployment over 8% for 43 consecutive months. You have a debt at $16 trillion, which is equal to our GDP of $16 trillion. You've got a deficit that the president continues to propose for the next 10 years of approximately $1.5 trillion per year. That is the entity that my opponent is saying can help you. I have a very different approach. I think there is a role that governments have. Look, I was a state legislator, I was a city alderman, I was a mayor, and now I'm honored to serve as a people's representative in the 1st Congressional District in Washington. But the key is, what is the size of government? How do we spend your tax dollars? They're not the federal government's tax dollars, they're your tax dollars. And I think you should demand and expect from us that we are effective, that we are efficient, and we're putting good practices and good business or good policies in place that are going to positively affect job creators. So, you know, in terms of what should we be doing, let's extend the existing rates. The existing rates, the same existing rates that the President of the United States extended.
These are the Bush tax cuts you're talking about.
The current rates, yes. I mean, actually, I would call them the Bush-Obama tax rates because President Obama also extended them.
Except for that last level, the $250,000 or above, right?
No, he extended all of them.
Yes, but he wants to.
Well, now what he wants to do. Now what he wants to do is there's six rates. He wants to send four of them. He wants to let two lapse, the top two. So here's what Ernst & Young says about if that occurs. Ernst & Young issued a report that said you're going to see GDP growth go from 1.9, which is anemic today, down to 1.3. You're going to see almost a million jobs lost across the country. And you're going to see, according to the president's numbers, $70 billion in revenue per year to the federal government. So I would ask the question, tell me if you get your tax hikes, what that $70 billion would do in the context of a $1.1 trillion deficit, because it doesn't solve the problem. And this is used as a political ad that Republicans want to support the wealthy, but there is no solution from the other side of the aisle on what you would do next, because $70 billion does not solve the problem.
Okay. Well, first let me say that I'm glad that he's talking about these numbers, because you have been there for 2 years. Now, granted, not many days, about 6 days a month, and you have been called the worst Congress ever. And not simply
Wait, 6 days a month? I have to let him jump
and
in
not,
on that.
Not simply, it's true, not simply by Democrats, but also by Republicans. They actually wrote a book about your Congress. It's called It's Worse Than It Looks.
Ms. Shea-Porter, can you address the economic issues that we're trying to get to here?
I'm working on it, okay? So what we have here is a Congress that has been standing in place. And what Mr. Ginta does not want to tell anybody is that because he signed a pledge to Grover Norquist, and everybody but seven members of the House of Representatives signed a pledge to Grover Norquist that there will never, ever, ever be a single penny of tax ever anywhere. And should there be, they will immediately find a place to return it. What you're leaving is a government in paralysis and a government in debt. And so we have a huge debt and we have a huge deficit. But you have not addressed that. What we need to be doing here is we need to find revenue. And, you know, Americans understand that. So we don't want to go after the middle class. No, of course not. All Americans are looking for is a kind of a fairness. We want to make sure that all of the subsidies that are called for the very, very wealthy are removed.
And in fairness, I need to let Mr. Ginta jump in real quick, and then we'll go to our last
segment.
Let me just make
this point. Senator Colburn, who's a very conservative Republican, wrote a book, and it's called Subsidies of the Rich and Famous. And that's where we need to go to start paying this down.
All right.
Because
Let's
government
go to
can't
Mr.
function
Ginta
without
for a moment.
Income.
Thank you. Mr. Ginta, real quick to you, and then we have one more round of questions from our panelists. Thanks.
Laura, the country is very frustrated because I think of comments like my opponent just made. What my opponent tends to do is try to attack me personally, it seems, in this last round, rather than talk about what the solutions are for the future of America. I am very willing to sit here before all of you and talk about solutions, talk about a vision for the country. You know, I'm a father, I'm a husband. My children are 9 and 7. And I'm very concerned about the America they will inherit. Now, my folks didn't go to college. They started a business. They worked hard. They were able to provide better for myself and my siblings than they had. And that's the America that I want to see for my children. Now, I believe very strongly that as a representative, my job is to represent everybody. Maybe we'll not agree 100% of the time, but my focus is to try to be a responsible, respectful representative when I'm here in New Hampshire and when I'm on the House floor, because that's what I think people want. So if you want to talk about the solutions that we've had, let's talk about the Jobs Act that my opponent claims we never passed.
And
we
Mr.
passed
Ginta,
it on April 5th. When it was signed into law April 5th of 2012 by the President of the United States, bipartisan jobs bill, Jobs Act, passed in the House, passed in the Senate.
That is not comprehensive jobs bill.
We are working to try to, well, then why would the President sign it?
Because
your response seems to be that it's not comprehensive or it doesn't meet certain qualifications.
This is the reality. Spirited campaign, and as it goes forward, I'm hoping to speak to both of you on the exchange,
I have to say that
which is my program on
that
Monday
it's a
morning.
Very small
and please
job
let
skill.
Me jump in here. Thank you. People are passionate about their politics, and that's good. And I really appreciate
and
both
passion
of you.
Is great, but you know we should do away with the personal attacks, and let's talk about solutions, and let's talk about facts.
And I want to thank both of you for this long form segment. It's been real interesting. Now we are going to return to our panelists for our final questions, and for these you will just have a 1 minute response, please. And the clock is our master, so if you could stick to that, we'd sure appreciate it. We begin with Phil Vaughn to Ms. Shea-Porter. Go ahead, Phil.
Ms. Shea-Porter, this question was inspired by an NHPR listener who wants members of Congress to work together on common problems. But voters will vote you in because they agree with your economic philosophies and not your opponent. So then how much will you reach across the aisle and work if elected?
Well, I think that we should. And I think if you look at the fact checker, they said that has not been happening in this Congress. And the reason, as I started to talk about the Republican and the Democrat, who wrote that book, Things Worse Than It Looks, said that this Tea Party is so ideologically bound and locked and refuses to reach out that we haven't been able to do that. It is my great hope that the far right will lose in this general election and that the Republican Party will send moderates so that we'll be able to talk to them. I'm from a Republican family, as everybody knows, and I know that this could happen if people would just open their hearts and be willing to step a little bit towards the middle. What we see now, though, is a Congress that is pulled very far right to the point where Speaker Boehner has had great difficulty with this Tea Party, this new freshman class. When that changes, we'll be able to talk again.
Mr. Ginter, same question.
Well, the answer is yes. I will continue to work with people on all philosophies, all ideologies, and across all political spectrums. I've had two pieces of legislation that have been signed into law by this president. I have worked with Congressman Barney Frank from Massachusetts, who identifies himself as a liberal, on fisheries issues that have been critical to Massachusetts and New Hampshire. We have worked in a bipartisan fashion as a delegation, not just on specific issues relative to the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard and the long-term transportation issues that affect that area, but also on sequestration. So we have passed in the House alone more than 30 different jobs bills, many of which were passed bipartisanly, that have been sent over to the Senate. Some have been signed into law by the president. So, you know, when there are good ideas and when there is good policy that is moving forward, that is when it's the best opportunity to work with people. I did this when I was mayor. You know, I was a Republican mayor in a Democrat city with 11 Democrats on the board, one independent, and two Republicans. And we were able to do things like cut taxes, cut borrowing, cut spending, and we were able to do this in a nonpartisan way.
I'll continue to work
in that fashion.
PolitiFact said that you are wrong claiming you did bipartisan.
Please hold on. We have one more question that we would love to get to, and that's to Mike Cody, and you will have 30 seconds, I believe, for this last question. Thank you for your patience.
Mr. Genta, you like small government. Can you name one business that has been helped by government funding?
One business that has been helped by government funding? Off the top of my head, I don't know one that has been helped by government funding.
Similar question. Ms. Shea Porter, you've promoted a more activist role for government. Is there a business you can name that has suffered by excessive regulation or taxes?
Well, let me answer his question. BAE has about 96-97% federal contracts, and they do good defense works, but they certainly benefit from that. And as for a business is hurt, anytime a small business has too much regulation, that hurts them. It's our responsibility to seek that out and make sure that they are not overburdened by any kind of paperwork there. But in general, small businesses have benefited from the Small Business Administration, and big businesses have benefited from a lot of tax cuts and supports for them.
All right. Thank you both. It has really been my pleasure to be here with you on the stage and my colleagues as well. And I want to thank everyone. That is all the time we have for this candidate forum. I want to thank our audience joining us here at the Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College, and to you at home for watching and listening. And again, especially thank you to our candidates, Democratic challenger Carol Shea Porter and Republican incumbent Congressman Frank Ginta. Thanks a lot for being here.